Nickel is an interesting dynamic where we had a big market already. You could take away from that market, you could cannibalize that market a little bit to feed into batteries, but eventually there's only so much of that you can do. And I think with nickel, like, you haven't seen the swings up and down in the price because you've been able to pinch from that other market. But at some point, there's a tip in that market, a tip in that supply story. We've scoured the globe literally for nickel sulfide projects. We bought the two best ones we could find. We bought Eagle's Nest and Cambaldo. But it just speaks to the scarcity of these projects. Like, there's not a lot of them around. And I think when I think about it, and I think about 1 million tons of nickel required, that's huge. Like, rare earths, second to nickel. I love rare earths. It's like, I've tried to find the best way to describe it. For me, rare earths is like the closest thing that we're ever going to get to pixie dust.
Righto, g'day, money mourners. We've got another bloody big showcase for you. God, we thought Rick Rule was showcase, and we keep lifting the bar for the money miners. Trav,
the difference between Rick Rule and this guest, mate, is that Rick Rule's got 1 million interviews out there. These guests have zero, to the best of my knowledge.
We'll have to congratulate you on this one, Trav. You've sourced this. You saw the opportunity. These infamous enigmatic characters didn't have any interviews out there, but we've got one. Very excited. Righto, tease it. Who is it?
Ever heard of Wyloo Metals before? What comes to mind when you think of them?
Well, Wyloo was actually the airport that I flew into for Paulson's. That was on Wyloo Station. That's what I thought that was the same people a while ago, but no.
That's not what I thought you were going to say.
True fact.
Oh, JD, what comes to mind when I say Wyloo Metals to you?
Tattarang, Mindaroo, Mincor,
Twiggy.
Twiggy.
Twiggy's Twiggy. Dosh. All yeah. of them. Twiggy and Nicola's Dosh.
But the people.
That's right.
There's the people who are coming up with the ideas and seeing opportunity and creating havoc in the M&A world. The two guys sort of doing the bulk of that are Luca Giacovazzi and Joel Turco, who are, you know, at the top of Wyloo there. So,
and they had a bit to say about that reputation, didn't they?
They sure did, mate.
Yeah, so we did one interview and it was that bloody good, the length of it. We decided to split it into two parts, and it was a logical split because part A, which we're going to rip for you today, is the commodity outlook, a bit more of a macro view, and then we're going to go into part B, which is the deals, the takeovers, the wheeling and dealing. So, look, part A today, boys, I guess we won't give too much away, but I like their general theme is how quick they can rip out capital. Someone big, that much money they got. I like the flavour that they bring.
Yep, and no one else has been more active in nickel sulfides than Wyloo in transactions in the last 3 years. So, like, you know, when they talk about nickel sulfides in the nickel market, you pay attention.
Right, boys, let's get into it. Part A with Wyloo, Luca Giacovazzi and Joel Turco. Here we go. Well, money mourners, haven't we got a treat today? Well, we're only allocated to use 92% of this office space. We're actually in the Mincor building with the Wyloo boys. Joel and Luca, welcome, lads.
Thanks for having us.
We've popped the cherry on the big setup for the transportable to West Perth. So,
well, mate, we were under the impression we were going to be setting up in the brewery. We're thinking, oh, how good's this? We're going to head to the bloody beautiful building and set up and get this like lovely landscape going. And you changed the address on us last week and sent us to West Perth for places.
The classic bait and switch.
Unbelievable. I hope the content of this podcast, you know, makes up for the change of venue. But good to see you guys in the Mincor office. And I hear you're moving in here as opposed to having the Mincor team.
You got to pay rent here, yeah. But don't you? Don't you own that building you're in?
Yeah. Good question, right? No. Tattarang's outgrown that building, so a lot of the portfolio companies are moving out, so we'll move into the space.
Very good. Boys, I'm sure everyone – you are a private company, so probably a lot of the money miners don't actually have a face to the name of Wyloo besides Andrew Forrest, but you guys are these are the guns steering the ship, using all Twiggy's money. Yeah. So, boys, introduce yourself. Tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into Wyloo.
Well, you kick it off, mate.
Yeah, sure. So, Luca Giacovazzi, I'm the CEO of Wyloo Metals. I don't know if there's much to say, but yeah, been part of the Tenerang group for about 7 years now. So I've worked with Andrew and John for a long time. Started up Wailu with Andrew 4 years ago now, roughly. And yeah, it's been a great journey, obviously seeing the company grow, done some cool deals, and yeah, sitting today in the Minco offices, which is quite special because it was one of our first investments. So nice to see us go kind of full circle back to where we started.
Very, very good. Yourself, Joel?
Yeah, I'm Joel Turco. I'm the GM of Strategy and BD at Wailu. I joined the business 2.5 years ago after spending a few years in the investment banking world. I'm the luckiest guy in the business because I joined, and I think it was my second or third week that we launched the takeover for Noront in Canada. So it's been all systems go, feels like, since I joined. I've just been holding on for dear life ever since.
What's it like having a big bloody budget?
Yeah,
but it's all help.
It's there's a lot of mouths to feed. There's a lot of competition for that capital, and there's a lot of really good ideas at Tatarang. So. It obviously it's great having strong financial backing, but we have to compete pretty hard and make a really good case for any of that capital. So, believe me, we're kept pretty honest when it comes to our investment decisions.
So, Luca, you said you started it with Andrew. What was the main catalyst for it to start while it was a private company?
I think at the time at Tatarang, we were really focused on building out the family office, and we were looking at a lot of different sectors. So, when I joined Tatarang, we had just made the investment in Harvey Beef. We're doing a lot in the ag space, doing a lot of property deals. And then we kind of went full circle, and I remember it was around the time when Andrew had started his PhD, and Andrew was spending a lot of time obviously studying and looking at the oceans and seeing the impact of climate change. And it really triggered us to kind of start to consider what are the kind of like big mega trends that we can play into from an investment perspective. And we were doing things in, as I mentioned, in food, and there were a couple of these big like trends that we were trying to play into. And then one that popped up was obviously decarbonization and what's it actually going to take to decarbonize. And I think when you start to scratch the surface and dig a bit below that, you really need metals to make the decarbonization story happen, because so much of the economy just needs to change. And that really sent us down the path. And I often think to myself, like, how did we end up in nickel and not in lithium? And it was really just a case of just opportunity that was in front of us. When we started up Wailu, the portfolio already had Poseidon Nickel in it. And we were kind of thinking around Poseidon and thinking, okay, well, how can we build around that? How else can we get more nickel exposure? Can we add lithium? And there was just a lot of more opportunity in the nickel space than in the lithium space. It was kind of at the point where lithium was just taking off, and nickel was just sitting around and no one was focusing on it. So we plowed headfirst into it, and as you guys know, we've done deals with most of the West Australian nickel companies. If you look through the history, at some point you would have seen Wailu on the register, as I mentioned, we've kind of gone full circle to now acquiring the one that we probably liked the most, which was Minco.
How close were you to getting into lithium?
We've been really close, and sometimes I kick myself because we were, splitting hairs over small amounts. We've had a crack at a few lithium projects, and unfortunately,
glad
I can't.
Glad you didn't blow him a no-no.
unfortunately, I can't go back in time. But I think lithium's got a great future, as does nickel. So both exciting commodities.
Guys, can we expand on the mandate of Wailu a bit more? You guys have been vocal that you have like quite a flexible range of instruments you can use, convertible notes, I've seen exchangeable notes, obviously buying equity. Can you just dig into that a bit more for us?
Yeah, I'm happy to start and then Turco jump in. But I think, around our mandate, it started with an idea, and then it's really been kind of opportunity driven. And I think that's been the nice thing, and it's really been a privilege to be part of the Tatarang group where, you guys were ex-investment bankers and you'll sit around your computer and go, man, this makes so much sense for these two things to come together, or somebody should fund them to go and do this.
Except in our case, we don't know how the mining works. So.
Yeah. Nor do we.
Creative on the Excel spreadsheet, not the mine plan.
Yeah, but I think the nice thing with Tatarang was we could take some of these ideas up to Tatarang and say, we think this makes a lot of sense. Can we go out and do it? And, we both – ex-bankers, Joel and I, and, you know, sometimes it requires unique structuring and we've been able to do that structuring. So, yeah, we've got a very flexible mandate, but it really comes down to does the opportunity make sense?
Yeah, and I think you mentioned, like, what's the mandate, and Luca gave the history of Tattarang and obviously in Mindaroo as well as being a values-driven organisation, a purpose-driven organisation, and that I think that's reflected in not only the commodities that we're targeting but the sorts of projects. So obviously nickel has its battery exposure, but then there's the nickel sulfide versus laterite angle as well. And so, you know, we're not just looking to invest in nickel at all costs. It's projects that we think have that can be developed sustainably, that can be a net contributor to decarbonisation. So yeah. But from the product's point of view, I think that we would say our ability to be flexible and nimble and move quickly is like a real strategic advantage of ours, but not just, oh, we're going to be long equity only, where, you know, whatever works at that time and in that particular opportunity, if we can make it work, then we're not hamstrung by, oh, we're only going to do debt, we're only going to do equity.
I think when people think of Wyloo, a few things come to mind. One is, obviously, the connection to Andrew Forrest. Another one is seeing how active Wyloo has been in the nickel space, the, you know, nickel developers and producers alike. And then, you know, another one is just seeing kind of exactly to that point how nimble and I guess like alternative structuring the entity has been in relation to some transactions. How do you, like, if you were to just like put a synopsis of how Wyloo looks at the world and the commodity sector? Like specifically, what are the key kind of the key principles or like the outlook on the world that you have that sort of everything else falls back into?
Oh, that's a good question. like we're obviously optimists around base metals, particularly base metals with the electrification and battery exposure. And I would say that we have a view that We're at a position now where it's just demand for the metals that are critical, and it's sort of demand for them at the expense of most other things. But I think that we have a view that over time there'll be an increasing value placed upon the sustainable footprint of them. And so that sort of drives our decision making, and that it's not, yes, we do worry about the near term, but we are looking beyond just the next 12 months of cash flow.
And how you mentioned deploying capital, you say you can deploy it quick. Does Twiggy have to put the rubber stamp on it, or how's the org structure work? Are you given full autonomy for the investments? Are you overseas? How does he run it in a way?
Yeah, we run it like every other investment business. We've got an investment committee that we take it to, and then eventually it goes up to Andrew and Nicola for final approval. But like every other, I guess, investment committee, you know, we go through our checks and balances and make sure that everyone's comfortable. And as Turco mentioned, there are competing uses for capital. Go through our process, make our case, and then take it up to Andrew.
Have you been in situations where there was two great opportunities but you had to pick one?
Many times. Yeah, several times. And I think that it's actually a really good thing to have that competition, because our competition for capital isn't just from the other commercial entities, it's from the philanthropic entities as well. And so, you know, I always say to people, it's like we need to demonstrate not just a good mining IRR, we need to demonstrate that this is a better use of Andrew and Nicola's capital than funding ocean research or cancer research as well. So we do have, there have been many opportunities that we've been like, oh, geez, I'd love to do both of these, love to do all three of these. And
if you see some plastic in the ocean, it's thanks to Joel.
Yeah, that's right.
We won't ask if you always pick the right one.
There was a period of time probably at the start of this year where we had probably three or four things and we were meeting once a week to sort of rearrange our priorities. Like if we could do that, you could only do one of these, which would it be? And they were shuffling around, and obviously Minco has always been at the top or near the top. And we got to a position where it was the timing worked out. Yeah.
Yeah, we're gonna go through the timeline, boys, of some of the big Wyloo deals.
Before that, we should talk nickel, Maddie.
Nickel in general before we get into the timeline.
I reckon we should.
Yeah. Nickel is a very interesting topic at the moment, isn't it? I know. Plenty of, I've never seen more different point of views. Everyone just thinks lithium's going up, but there's nickel's got so many different views, and you're obviously very long on nickel, but I guess we've had plenty of chats with people about the class one, class two, sulfides, laterites, the impact of the IRA, the impact of all this extra supply coming online from the HPALs in Indonesia compared to much lower tonnages and volumes coming out of the sulfides. I guess no question really, general chit chat. I think it's the best way to attack this one because where do you start?
Yeah, I'm happy to have a go.
Leave it to the big dog, Joel.
I reckon, look, it's a really interesting one, and we obviously think about this a lot, and we're deeply invested in nickel.
You bloody hope so.
But, you know, it's I think when you look at the, and I hate like quoting demand supply forecasts, but what's needed for nickel and the amount of tons you can actually produce, you're right. Like, you know, a large sulfide operation, you know, a big mine can do 30, 40,000 tons of nickel. Yeah. Mincor will do somewhere between 10 and 20, and it's a reasonably sized business. I think when you think and you put that into perspective of what's actually needed, when you're talking 1 to 2 million tons of nickel required, it's significant. And I don't think people appreciate how hard it is to bring new nickel online. Even if you're assuming huge growth in Indonesian HPAL, it's still a very significant number. A very big HPAL operation might do 80,000 tons of nickel. To get to a million tons of nickel, which is probably at the low end of what's required, it's significant. You need a massive build out of nickel supply. So, you know, you asked the question, like, which commodities, how do we think about commodities? How do we think about, you know, where to focus our effort? Like, you know, you can look at supply and demand forecasts, but you've really got to focus on look at projects. Like, what projects do you think genuinely are going to come online? And I think that's something we don't do enough of, because there is just a huge, you know, we've scoured the globe literally for nickel sulfide projects. We bought the two best ones we could find. We bought Eagle's Nest and Kambalda. There are very few others. Like, you look at BHP, didn't get Eagle's Nest. The next best was Kabanga. Kabanga's got its own issues in Tanzania. Very difficult project to get going. But it just speaks to the scarcity of these projects. Like, there's not a lot of them around. And I think when I think about it, and I think about a million tons of nickel required, that's huge. It's massive. It's billions and billions of dollars of investment that's required. Yeah. So I think that gives me a lot of comfort. And it's the other thing that I think is really interesting between like a nickel, like compare nickel to copper to lithium. You think about, I always think about lithium as a commodity that will be a bulk commodity. And it's in its infancy and it's like finding its way to becoming a bulk. So there's going to be choppy times. But there's a lot of lithium out there. There's a lot of projects that can be bought online, which is very different to nickel. Nickel is an interesting dynamic where we had a big market already and you could you could take away from that market. You could cannibalize that market a little bit to feed into batteries. But eventually there's only so much of that you can do. You can only steal so much from the stainless steel market before you reach a supply problem. And I think with nickel, like, you haven't seen the swings up and down in the price like you have with lithium, because you've been able to pinch from that other market. But at some point, there's a tip in that market, a tip in that supply story. And then you think about copper just being a huge market, and you just need to add incremental supply all the time, but already a very big market. So it's about finding those additional mines to keep that supply up and keep it growing. So it's like lithium, like, start from zero. Nickel, probably, like, you know, like, I think about it like a tipping scale. At some point, it's going to tip over. And then copper, just, you got to find the supply and keep bringing it online.
What would you class as some of the highest quality nickel sulfide assets globally? What are the standout ones?
I'm happy to go again.
No doubt from a
undeveloped perspective, from an ore body perspective, Kabanga's world class.
Yeah, Kabanga.
Eagle's Nest is up there. It's one of the best.
And what about developed ones? Like, what are some of the best operations that you look at globally, the real state, like the green bushes of nickel?
There are none, really. That's the problem. Yeah. You think about Nova, there's only got a couple of years left. Yeah. You think about Eagle, that's coming to an end. There are very few high-quality sulfide projects that have got a long life, and most of them are coming to an end in the next, you know, max 3 years kind of thing. Forrestania is finishing up. There's not much. Then you've obviously got the Sudbury Basin, which is a significant producer. Not the lowest cost producer in the world, but still a significant producer. They kind of short concentrate in the next couple of years as well. You think about Nickel West, they really struggle to make their business profitable. Very dependent on places like Kambalda. So there's not a lot of them. And ultimately, the world will have to turn. That's why we always get asked the question, are you concerned about Indonesia and laterites? I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing that we add that baseload nickel into the system. We need that nickel into the system. But we should also go after the high-quality sulfide projects because they're better from a carbon perspective.
Yeah. Imagine if you could rewind 20, 30, 40 years and go back to the 80s in Kambalda, like Jubilee and Cosmos, some of those. Look at how sensational those assets were and how predominant and not as deep nickel sulfides are. Because, a lot of the stuff coming online, look at Odysseus for IGO, very poor. They're going below Cosmos to get new nickel. So it's all challenging and deep in ultramafics with the ground pressure in Australia. God, you'd be flying in the 80s if Wailua was around then.
I know. I feel like, just on Lucas' point, I feel like a lot of the discourse around the nickel sector often focuses on sulfides or laterites. And I think that to echo Lucas' point, our view would be that it's sulfides and laterites. And ultimately, you don't want it to shut down all laterite production because then nickel becomes absurdly expensive and it gets substituted out of batteries. So, our view is certainly that, all nickel projects are important. We certainly feel that, you can take – when you talk about the supply-demand deficit, yes, it's a big number already, but if you drill a bit deeper and instead of just looking at supply and demand, it's demand for what and supply of what. Yeah. And the demand forecasts are predominantly being driven by – battery requirements, so you're going to need battery grade nickel or nickel that can be converted into a battery product, and the supply does not respond accordingly, right? So there's not a wealth of sulfide, nickel sulfide projects that can be at a lower carbon footprint converted into a battery grade product. So I think that's why our focus is so heavily on sulfides, but it's not to say laterites are garbage and shouldn't be a part of the system. To Lucas' point, you need that supply in order to feed that.
I'm curious about those the laterites. To talk about it specifically, we've heard the analogy that the HPALs being developed in Indonesia and the laterite development happening over there is analogous in some ways to the introduction of shale to the oil markets. Except in the case of shale, it turned out to be the marginal cost.
Supply, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a marginal supply, right? So, however, there's a chance that the laterite coming out of Indonesia will actually, be Q2 or Q3 of the cost curve instead. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that characterization and its sort of impact on the nickel market?
Yeah. To your point, I think that, and look, it remains to be seen where the cost profile of those HPAL plants come out. But at the moment they are, as you said, the difference being that it's not just, they're marginal, they're going to be the marginal producer and they'll fill that final increment. It looks like they will be more that base load.
Is there just the one at the moment? Is it Narita, the one HPAL plant that's being commissioned in Indonesia?
There's a few in
four or five
that are operating.
Operating,
I know, because I know the first one was commissioned was a Harita Group, think, and they're obviously bloody another seven on the way. Yeah.
And so I think that what we'll – and look, I won't pretend to be an Indonesian HPAL expert, but from what little I know about it is, it isn't some highest marginal cost producer. It will be perhaps a larger, as you say, baseload supplier. I think the question just becomes what final product are they producing, and then ultimately will customers apply a premium or a discount if the sustainability criteria aren't there? Having said that, I've read a lot about the new developments being environmentally friendly, trying to incorporate safer tailings disposal, trying to incorporate renewable power generation in the supply chain. So as I said, not an expert on it, but I don't think that we'll see that. Everything I've read about it is not, it's small volume, marginal production. It's actually larger volume, as you said, Q2, Q3, hitting some of that base load.
Joel, I'd love to dive deep into that discount you mentioned there. Taking the sort of long view in base metals and specifically in nickel, there is a lot of sort of chatter that you could see a bifurcation in prices dependent on the ESG credentials of the source of these base metals. How do you guys sort of view it? That obviously you're buying assets, so you're taking quite a long view.
Yeah.
How do you sort of think about the bifurcation?
Yeah, I mean, that this bifurcation of the nickel market concept has been floated for, well,
how many times a week do you
hear
that?
Yeah, I mean, I hear it for years. And look, I think that what the IRA seeks to do is to provide a sort of price incentive. It says, you know, EVs will be eligible for a subsidy if the materials in it can meet XYZ criteria. Therefore, if you are a supplier of materials that meet that criteria, ostensibly you should be able to claim a premium for that, or at least if you're not able to satisfy that criteria, you receive a discount. I think what we are seeing is that we're at the really, really early stages of that, and I don't think that price incentive has flowed through the supply chain yet. And I think that we, as the market matures, we'll start to see that. But what's interesting, I think no one really understands this yet because it's so new, is that who kind of holds the bargaining power in that supply chain? You know, automobile supply chains are notoriously tight margins and work pretty hard. So I think that we'll start to see that play out in the coming years as the impact of the IRA actually flows through. Do we start to see OEMs either being eligible or ineligible for those subsidies?
And I've heard Andrew speak about the sort of importance of the IRA with regards to some of his other businesses and setting up downstream facilities in the US. How much of a thinking has that been in some of the acquisitions you guys have done? You've obviously done a lot of work in Canada and Australia, sort of first world countries. How does it sort of play into the investment process for you guys?
Yep.
Yeah. It probably happened organically for
us.
Yeah,
it did,
I think we were just focused on countries where we thought we could operate well. So obviously we focused on Australia, and then Canada was attractive to us. And then the IRA came out, and we've just been fortunate enough that all our nickel falls within the IRA. I mean, just on that topic around kind of the bifurcation of the market, everyone initially was talking about class one versus class two nickel, will the market bifurcate? And it has. Like, that's what everyone's missed, is that it has, but it's happened through payabilities. Mm. You just haven't seen a separate market emerge, but you're getting paid very different payabilities today for a class two product versus a class one product. So a good example is like, you know, when we were running our models on sulfide mines, we used to assume 73% payabilities, where today, you know, we're getting offered by traders north of 85, 88% payabilities. So I think you've already seen the market adjust to that, paying a lot more for a product that can become class one. And then the other thing that we find quite interesting, we were just talking about this earlier today, is you can see it in the traders' behavior. I think that's always, like, for me, that's always like a leading indicator of where the market's heading. And like, when was the last time you saw Glencore as aggressive in locking up a supply for a specific commodity as they've been in the last 3 months? Let me know.
Can you speak to that?
Yeah, like, think about, they've just done PolyMet overnight and announced the deal there. They've just done Santa Rita. They've put money across a couple of little juniors where they've provided money as convertible notes. You've never seen them been that aggressive in locking up concentrate. And it's not necessarily that they've locked up projects or acquired projects for their portfolio, but they've locked up the concentrate offtake. And I think that's really interesting. The world is definitely significantly short sulfide concentrate. And look, you can talk about lots of different products. You can talk about MHP, MSP. There's lots of different versions of nickel. But the most, I guess, versatile of all the intermediate products that you can make is actually concentrate.
So the nickel price is, what have you picked it was going to be where it is like a year or two ago? Has it not really gone to plan what the nickel price has done today? Like the fact that it's gone down?
If you told us 4 years ago nickel is going to be $30,000 a ton Australian, we would have been singing.
If I could flatline this nickel price through my model for the next 15 years, I'd take it.
Yeah, right.
In real terms, though, right?
Yeah, of course. Of course. Sorry, of course. Always real terms.
I think if your project's not making money at the snickle price, then you probably miss the cycle. I think where we currently are is very sustainable. It's sustainable from an OEM perspective, and it's sustainable from a producer perspective. Of course, we'd love to see the nickel price go higher, but right now I think it's actually in quite a good equilibrium.
Guys, beyond nickel, we've obviously beaten that one out, but before we get into some more deal-specific stuff, I'm keen to talk about a couple other commodities. Firstly, maybe not the most interesting, but gold, I'm keen to hear how that plays in. There was obviously the sort of tilt at getting a 20% stake in Regis last year, the stake in Greatland Gold as well. That sort of sits outside of this battery sort of philosophy, this battery metal philosophy that you guys have. How do you guys look at gold as an investment?
Yeah, I think a lot of those, well, certainly the Regis one was sort of opportunity driven. I think at the time we saw the entire gold sector trading at pretty chunky discounts to NAV, and you know, I think that we'd been following the gold sector enough to know that typically doesn't last very long, and so that was really just opportunity driven. It was a mature business with great assets that was trading at a healthy discount, and so that was just a financial opportunity, and we sought to capitalize on that, and we fell agonizingly short of the raid, but it still worked out to be a good investment for us.
Yeah, not much more to add to that. I think we were just economics junkies, thought gold would go for a bit of a run and wanted to have a position. So we took a crack at Regis, and we still had a pretty big position there. So we were just under 5%, and it worked out quite well for us. We bought I think at the time we did the raid, what was the Regis share price?
About like $1.40. I think it was $1.30 something, and the bid price was $1.40.
$1.48, I think.
Right, we'll get the mill rats back in. Interesting. We'll talk about processing.
Yep.
It's for this Wyloo, you've got the Kambalda concentrator owned by BHP. You've got, I guess the next another option is you've got Nova, I think. So it's truckable. The options, because of the Kambalda concentrator, with BHP owning it, it is small, needs a lot of work. What's the plan with this?
Yeah, look, there are a lot of concentrators around WA that could take feed from us.
And I suppose I'll put the note in before about the one I want to ask about the Nova concentrator is that because Nova have that, they sell their premium clean con, whereas they're now with the Mincor assets with potentially having arsenic in it, not fitting with that clean con. So, yeah, if you can talk to that as well.
I think you did a podcast on all the different feeds that are going into that concentrator at the moment.
Was that right? Was any of that right? I confused the shit out of myself doing that one.
Yeah, a couple of mistakes.
Distinction, high distinction territory. Knocking on the door of a high distinction area.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, but there are a lot of concentrators. I think West Australia is not short concentrating capacity, but obviously you're trying to truck product long distances. I think from our perspective here with Mincor, our offtake agreement with BHP ends in 2.5 years. And then we need to make a decision about what we do from there. And one of the options is certainly to build our own concentrator. And that's not as big a ordeal as people make it out. We don't need to build a big concentrator. We've got very high-grade ore, so it doesn't need to be a big mill. It can actually be quite small. And in many ways, running a smaller concentrator helps you with your recoveries. People don't realize going through Kambalda, sometimes it gets batched. And when you're trying to batch ore going through that concentrator, you lose out on some of your recoveries from your stop-start. So, you know, we're looking at all those options at the moment to decide what's best for us. There's trucks that are coming to Kambalda that are going back empty to Nova and Forrestania, for example. So there's a lot of options around the region to consider where we might place our ore. And one of them might be a longer-term agreement with BHP. It just depends where we end up.
That episode I did, was I correct in saying the timeline, how it's lining up with BHP what they're doing to the Kalgoorlie nickel smelter to then to deal with lower FEMGO ratio ore, which is what comes from Leinster and Mount Keith, because you're, the Mincore ore is a very important factor in the Nova ore, what Nova ore goes there to the concentrator for that blend. Is that how it's all going to line up? Because your agreement with BHP finishes in 2026 or just before, doesn't it?
Just before,
yeah. So is that sort of how things are playing now? 2026 is going to be that key year.
Yeah, I think ours is December 25. It rolls off. And then, look, I don't really know what BHP's plans are. They've obviously got West Musgrave now, which is another option for them. But we do know that that Kambalda feed, look, when it was built by WMC back in the day, it was all around blending multiple sources of feed to allow ore bodies like Mount Keith and Leinster to come through the system. That might change now with the smelter rebuild and West Musgrave. We're not privy to those discussions. But I think one thing we do feel very comfortable with is that there's a market for our product. Be it that it goes through Kambalda concentrate or that we build our own or we go with a third party, we're very confident that we can either sell the ore or sell our concentrate.
And what's the most strategic location for a mill? If you did go down that road, is it going to be Kambalda? Is it going to be Cassini?
That's a good question because naturally you kind of gravitate to the brand new mine, which is Cassini, so you want to put it maybe in Widgie. But at the same token, we think we've got some really good exploration targets up in Kambalda. We don't think the Kambalda story is fully understood. And, you know, when you talk to the geologists, they'll always say to you, we don't actually think we've found the best ore body in Kambalda yet. And we're getting some exciting exploration results already starting to come through, which is great. So it's a question where you actually put it. Do you locate it by the ore body that you know has already got long life, or do you back yourself to build it in Kambalda? One of the advantages in Kambalda is we've got some freehold land up there, so it's a lot easier to permit. So these are all the kind of things that we're working through at the moment. It just takes a bit of time. You've got to fully understand, as much as we know this business well, we're learning new things every day. We're learning about lots of potential that it has, lots of opportunity, lots of things that the team have considered in the past. And I think the great thing with Wyloo coming in is, you know, historically this has been a junior mining company that's always almost existed for BHP, where now we can take a very different lens to it and say, no, we can actually go and build our own concentrator and own our own destiny. So it just takes us a little bit of time to work through those studies and figure out exactly what we want to do.
And what about the fact that you've got to start your own tech services division now? because how this has worked, you've taken over Mincore, you're going to run their mines, you are now the Wyloo, the mine managers, the general managers, the geologists, the engineers.
Give a look for a hard hat.
That's right. Yeah. hope on the transfer of everyone over just to matter of changing a shirt, but it's not just a simple click of the fingers to establish all that. Is that a bit of a challenge?
Well, look, we're going through all that integration work at the moment. I think one thing we've always said about Mincore is that we like its assets, the ones in the ground, and we like its assets, the ones that walk around on top of the ground. They've got good people here, people who understand Kambalda and Widgie really, really well. And, you know, we're not looking to come in, like, you know, Wyloo's less than 20 people. So it's like we can come in and fill every seat. The idea is it's a genuine merger of the two businesses. We're complementary businesses. We've got complementary skill sets. You know, there's great geologists, there's great operators here. We're a very, very savvy investment business with financial strength. So we're sort of bringing the best of breed together. So that's sort of the way we think about it. It's not lost on us that all of a sudden, we have we own operating mines now. Mm. So, you know, all of those operating risks are very real. We also have some very experienced mining and geological people on the Wyloo team who can provide a bit of an oversight role, but it's very much, bringing everyone from Mincore along for the journey as well.
Very good. I'll shut up now, Joe. You can go.
I'm fascinated to hear about the PCAM facility and the plans. You mentioned that there's only 20 people here. Just to start with, how do you guys sort of go about that? That's very different to building or buying a mine, operating a mine. How have you guys first gone about building up the expertise and getting up the curve on what that could look like?
Yeah, we've been drinking from the fire hydrant a lot. I think we had, you know, we have a engineer, like very experienced engineer and metallurgist and geologist. We've got some technical capability, but on the metallurgical front, we're learning really quickly. We'd done a fair bit of work before our engagement with IGO, and then obviously since entering into that agreement with them, we're sort of partnering with them, and we're learning from what they've learned as well. But it's certainly understanding. I think the trickiest part is not so much the obviously I won't pretend to understand the flow sheet. That's not an area that I have any expertise in. But I think understanding the global sort of specialty materials capability, like who are the major players, which OEMs are they aligned with, where do they get their feed from? That's something that up until recently wasn't in the remit of mining companies. We just dig the dirt and sell it. But as everyone looks to explore further downstream, trying to understand where does the material come from or where does this mine's material go and who owns that midstream processing space really well, that's something that we have been spending a lot of time on the last sort of 12 to 18 months.
There's a lot of criticism to be kind of blunt about Australia and West Australia's prospects of going like that far downstream. The PCAM facility isn't the final step. It's not manufacturing a battery.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you guys sort of respond to the criticism that it's a bit of a, you know, perhaps a pipe dream for us to be able to do it here, that we don't have the manufacturing expertise and those sorts of things? How do you guys kind of respond to that?
And I guess, and are the people that are buying the precipitate, are they going to pay the extra for Australians to refine it or take it, just buy the concentrate and do it themselves?
Yeah. We've certainly had enough interest from, you know, key players in that processing space to know that it's not just a pipe dream. I think that the idea of and look, there are divergent opinions on this and I might one day be proved to be a fool, but I think there are reasons why if we look at batteries, like EV batteries in automobile supply chain, I think there's a reason why battery manufacturing in Australia is challenging. I think that EV batteries are part of an automobile supply chain. Automobile supply chains run on a just-in-time inventory management system and they're not built here. So you want the batteries to be pretty close to where the cars are.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to ship something that's very heavy a long, long way. So I think that the battery manufacturing is hard, but it does make sense for, as we said, any sort of downstream processing requires scale. So it does make sense for, if you require scale and require partnership, it does make sense for some processing to be located close to where the supply is coming from. I think that logically makes sense to have a cluster of, if you need multiple mines to feed some midstream processing center, for those to be located. I think the question then becomes, well, how far downstream do you go before what's the final product that leaves the country? I think that's the, in my opinion, the conversation should be more how far downstream, not should we or shouldn't we make batteries. I think that's a really like black and white decision, whereas I think the grey is in the how far downstream. Is it PCAM or is it CAM? You know, and that look, that's just me looking at the nickel cathode material supply chain.
What about the potential for Australia to make batteries for the mining industry?
Yeah.
Like if you're talking about transporting heavy batteries, like all the mining trucks and loaders and everything are currently made in Sweden and Finland and they've got to ship them all the way over here. And the fact that there's going to be, it's all just a battery change out system, is there potential for that sort of thing in Australia for the mining industry?
I feel like Australians just never back themselves. It's a very bad habit we have. Like, I'm a little different to Joel. The whole battery story, like I can't pinpoint a very, very solid reason why we couldn't do it here. Look, we've got high cost structures. We've got all those kind of things that we'd have to work around. But what I don't think we fully have seen the full force of is having control over critical minerals and the minerals required and what that means and how you use that. I don't think we've seen the full impact of that. And I think we can leverage that to have create that industry here. Now, whether or not we want to is a different story. Like, does it make sense? Or is there not enough margin in making a battery? So why bother when you can actually just make a good, high-quality chemical product that you can export? That's a very different question. We're not trying to employ thousands and thousands of people. That's not the goal. That's not the position Australia's in today. We're really trying to add value to something unique and special to this country. So I think you need to ask the question in a different way. I don't think there is a reason why we couldn't make a battery here, but it doesn't make sense to make it here.
I think it's an if not, why not sort of a question at each stage. It's like, well, if not, why? And then assessing it on a case-by-case basis. I presented a conference recently and I sort of put forward my thesis on where in the nickel supply chain we had a right to play in Australia. But I caveated it by saying, I'm just looking at this through the from the perspective of nickel cathode materials. It might be completely different for vanadium that goes into the, you know, flow batteries, things that I don't understand as well. You know, so I think that it's a case-by-case basis. It should never be a case of we'll never make batteries here of any sort, draw a line through it. I think that each one needs to be assessed on its merits of, well, what is the end market? What are the drivers that are requiring production of that to be based in XYZ country and can be here? So yeah, it's not as sexy an answer. It's not some black and white answer, but I think that the answer is always in the gray, these things.
And I think with it, it's such an interesting one because it's kind of like we start off with sulfate. That was the first step. And then we were like, oh, well, it's actually better logistically to produce PCAM. It travels better. And then it's like, well, why don't we make CAM? Because we've got all the other metals.
You've got
the
lithium here as well, yeah.
Should we make CAM? And it's like when you go through it, there's kind of like, oh, no, but, you know, we want lots of CAM plants feeding one, lots of PCAM feeding one CAM. And then you stress test it and you're like, no, not really. Like you could actually make CAM here and make good money out of it. So I think, look, my view on it all is you need to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And the start of it is PCAM, and that's why we've gone down this path. And then we can build off of it from there and see where it takes us. But I don't think there's a hard reason why we couldn't be more ambitious to, if it makes sense to make a very bespoke style battery for the mining sector, there's not a justified reason why we couldn't do it here. You can get around labor costs by automating things and using technology. You can get around cost of capital. The IRA's done that for us. At the end of the day, it's made it more, you can invest the capital because you receive a premium on the other side. So look, I think we should be optimistic but the first step is let's walk before we can run. Let's make some PCAM and then we can go from there.
And what about now that you're mine owners? And of course congratulations. I don't think we've actually congratulated you formally.
So rude.
Underground mine electrification. Because especially with the thematic and the green theme of the Wyloo and Mindaroo, especially with the squadron arm and everything. Because that is a big hill to climb.
Yeah.
For the industry, not for a company, because especially with the fact that the OEMs can't really supply it yet, and deep mines with a lot of existing decline development. It'd be all good if you put a new shaft in and could power that by electricity, but a lot of the existing infrastructure relies on diesel combustion. I guess how are you going to first tackle that?
I think that's another good conversation to have because you know we mentioned Wiley's a 20-person team. We've acquired this business. Love the people here at Mincor. They're very good operators. We've known them for years. But the thing you forget, we're part of Tatarang, which employs hundreds of people. And part of Tatarang is Squadron Energy. You've got FFI at Fortescue. So there's a heap of learnings and kind of cross-pollination that happens across
our
group.
Williams.
So we've kind of got these insights into what some of those companies are doing, what they're working on, and helps us understand the technologies better, which helps us position where we want to be. When it comes to kind of electrification of mines and how the industry needs to, I guess, change, look at Mincor again, something we'll have to look at. But one area that we have a really great opportunity is our mine in Canada. You can start with a blank canvas, which is awesome. We're trying to build that mine as a net zero operation, and the first step to that is just to electrify everything.
Yeah.
So that we've only got a single point. It's our electricity generation that we need to decarbonize. And we do that through wind, through solar, through batteries, through hydrogen. We've got a number of different energy studies underway, but that's the beauty of starting with a new mine that's got a big resources. You can really
building it with the future in mind.
You can really build it with the future in mind. And that's the amazing opportunity I think that gets lost with Eagle's Nest is it's actually a chance when, naturally as a mining company, you get a lot of opposition from environmentalists. And I think something that they're missing is the world needs these minerals so badly. And here you have an opportunity to build a mine that can really be the poster child for what mining should look like in the future and really be a super clean operation. Net zero, and the other cool thing that we're doing with Eagle's Nest is we're putting all our tailings underground, so we won't have a surface tailings dam, which is incredibly unique. And when you think about that mine, including a concentrator, will take up less than 1 square kilometer and not produce any emissions. That's pretty incredible. That nickel will be the cleanest nickel in the world.
And I suppose having Mr. Forrest's wallet to work with for this makes it is probably the thing that will help you do that too. Because to electrify an underground mine as a greenfield, it's delaying the first bit of ore because you need the capital to go deep to get the shaft, the vertical development in the shaft infrastructure to electrify a mine so you can start hoisting. Whereas a lot of companies won't want to delay that first bit of ore and put the capital in. And I assume that Wyloo will be in a good position to be able to do that for their operations.
And the project does it on its own. It is such a high quality ore body that it can justify that spend. And look, at the end of the day, I do think there will be a difference in payabilities for the nickel that will come out of Eagle's Nest versus nickel that's coming out of Indonesia that's 7 or 8 times more carbon intensive.
Is that because of the ESG stamp that will
I think mining companies, it's not just ESG, it's ESG, it's RA, it's long-term supply. So the great thing that we have as a business is all of our offtake is essentially available. And that puts us in an incredibly strategic position. And, you know, OEMs, traders, they don't want to lock up just 1 or 2 years worth of supply. They want to try lock in 20 years worth of supply. You got to try find a nickel sulfide mine that's net zero, that's got a super low footprint with 20 years worth of supply. You won't find it anywhere in the world.
Fully electrified.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hope it, it'd be great to see the first movers on it because, and especially from a greenfields, to have a mine specifically designed to be a fully electrified mine and to see it from start to finish. Yeah. I think you're on a pretty exciting journey there.
We'll do a site visit in Canada, hey, Matty?
Yeah. Hey, we just got some high vis the other day embroidered with Bunny and mine. So, mate, we're good to go.
Beautiful. Did you get the winter version? Because it's cold.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So sick of that. Three ply at least.
As cold as Kambalda at Diggers, because we'll check out Kambalda.
We'll have to get some bomber jackets and blue jackets as well.
Yeah.
Right, let's get into the deals. I want to get into the deals, boys. That's the juicy stuff.
You and me both.
Guys, it's an investment that you guys made that I found super, super fascinating. The the deal with Hastings, the $150 million, which was an exchangeable note. I'm just excited to hear about the sort of thought process. You know, you don't see exchangeable notes all that sort of often. How did the idea come about? Obviously, there was a few companies circling Neo Performance Materials, which the sort of stake is kind of in. But how did that all come about?
Yeah. I think before you even get into the deal, like, why is it interesting? And I love, like, rare earths, second to nickel, I love rare earths. It's like I've tried to find the best way to describe it. For me, rare earths is like the closest thing that we're ever going to get to pixie dust. It's like this. It's this magical thing that just makes everything better. When you use a rare earth magnet, it's 20% more efficient than a non-rare earth magnet. And like that might sound like a little efficiency improvement, but when you put it into a car and you go, your battery can be 20% smaller, your weight can be 20% more, whatever it is. Like it's huge. That's from a car company perspective. When we're trying to lower the cost of EVs, incorporating rare earths is a huge driver. And I remember the first time I was kind of getting into it and I read this case study about, it was actually Neo invented this rare earth magnet that went into a heat pump motor, and Europe had mandated that everybody needed to replace their heat pump motors with this magnet. And they did the study on what it meant for the European Union, and it removed something like 3 or 4 coal power plants out of the system just replacing this little magnet, right? And like for me, it's just such a special thing. Like, what else on earth makes things that much better?
Yeah. Is that the same? Is it the same for wind turbines as well?
Like same with wind turbines
and DPR magnets.
DPR magnets.
So you imagine how many wind turbines you see in the countryside of Australia. How much more power generation that is.
That's right. Any electric motor, any electric generator. So,
And incredibly recyclable, which is the great thing as well. Like, it's very easy to take a wind turbine magnet and reuse it, which again is something that it's just. Yeah, just these incredible little minerals that make the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pixie dust. I love it.
Yeah. And then you're thinking of getting into niobium by any chance?
Oh, that, one of our colleagues, he loves the obscure, and he's probably out there still when this finishes. If you go and find Martin and talk niobium, better go.
Oh, they've got to be looking for a bit of capital, possibly.
Yeah, go grab a pint down there. You might need a few pints because he loves the topic. So.
Niobium's a fascinating one as well, and again, plays into the kind of rare earth story. But when you're thinking about, you said, you know, why don't we make batteries for mining equipment here in WA? The technology that is emerging in niobium batteries is actually really fascinating because it doesn't have the highest energy density. It doesn't have all the great stuff that nickel has and that a cobalt-based battery might have. But what it does have is the ability to recharge and recycle orders of magnitude more times. And that's fascinating from a mining equipment perspective because you're not running your mining fleet like you're running your daily commuter. You've got to be able to recharge the thing many, many more times than you can an EV battery. So it's a fascinating space, and I actually do think niobium has a big role to play in decarbonisation.
What about vanadium? Now, that's because I know that's more your large-scale baseload battery. Operations that will need a lot of capital to get started, but it's one of those things, the vanadium batteries need the uptake to get cheaper.
Yeah.
That's the biggest hindrance.
Yeah. Another one of those classic chicken
and egg situations. Have another crack at Windamara.
Yeah.
It's another fascinating one. It's not one that we're particularly close to.
No.
That's all I need to know.
It's not one that – a recent conference I spoke at, there was a few vanadium developers there and I had a chat with them in the sidebar and they said, hey – different to nickel cathode batteries, vanadium batteries do have a place to be built here. They were adamant, like there's a place for vanadium, for Australian built vanadium flow batteries because the market's here for them. And so look, it's
they're being built here already in Bibra Lake.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, it's a different dynamic. And that's why, as I said earlier, you can't just take some broad brush approach and say battery shouldn't be built in Australia. It's like, well, what sort of battery and for which customer? So it's an emerging... We have the same conversations around different EV batteries. Oh, it's you know, NMC batteries or LFP or sodium ion. But my personal view is it's not going to be one or the other. It'll be a smorgasbord of batteries in the way that there's a 4-cylinder, 6-cylinder and 8-cylinder engines. There's different strokes, different folks, and therefore there will be, you know, longer range cars that require NMC batteries that might require a bit more of a premium. There'll be your, you know, lower energy density, shorter range runarounds. It might be, you know, LFP.
And so you've got to supply the whole world.
Exactly. And I think that's actually beneficial for miners because if everyone flocks to one chemistry type, then it becomes very expensive and then there's a substitution effect. So I think that what you actually want is a sustainable smorgasbord of technology.
Yeah. The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.